Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Megan Gorman, and I will be your host. Today, we are going to be talking with Greg McBride, Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. Greg has more than a quarter century of experience in personal finance. His commentary regularly appears in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, as well as appearing on TV on CNBC, NBC News, and ABC World News Tonight. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Megan. Great to be with you.
I know we're going to talk about the economy and what's going on today, but before we get started, I think it's always good to start off our interviews with a little bit about you and your career path, because I'd love to know, how do you get to be the chief financial analyst for Bankrate.com?
Well, I've spent my entire career in financial services. Personal finance is not just a career, it's a passion. It's long been a passion. I started out, I worked in consumer lending for a few years. So that really gave me a front row seat to the state of household balance sheets. You know, seeing how much money people owed, seeing what their monthly budgets were like, who was long on assets and short on debts, and who was long on debts and short on assets. And all of that became, you know, very vital experience. Wanted to transition my career into more of an analyst role, you know, landed at Bankrate, kind of worked my way up the ladder since. Been at Bankrate over 20 years. And, you know, have also had the benefit, if you want to call, you know, agent experience, the benefit of that, I suppose, is having seen several cycles, you know, good and bad, bubbles in tech stocks, bubbles in real estate, and, you know, obviously the depths of the dot-com bust, the depths of the financial crisis, and then everything we've witnessed in the last 14 months.
Having that experience, and I've been in the industry almost 20 years, it feels like we've been around the block quite a few times.
There's been a lot happening, that is for sure.
So really briefly, before we get into it, let's talk about what is Bankrate? Because I was shocked when I read your bio that you'd been there for over 20 years. I thought Bankrate was probably relatively new.
Bankrate is a personal finance website, and the company's actually been around, got started in the mid to late 70s as a newsletter publisher. Bankrate, the original Bankrate, published industry newsletters and was really the original in the area of surveying bank rate and fee information, and then offering that is available either to institutions for competitive purposes or to consumers for the benefit of comparison shopping. About the mid-90s, Bankrate moved onto the web, and you know that very quickly became the primary business. So Bankrate's got a rich history, even online, you know, more than 25-year history of being the one-stop shop, that comparison place, the comparison shop for consumers that are in the market for financial services or just, you know, looking for advice or how to make an informed financial decision.
It's a site I like a lot and I find very, very informative. So I think it's helpful to know exactly what role it functions in the personal finance world. So let's get into the economy. We've been in unprecedented times for 15 months, right? And we keep hearing that term and hearing that term. And all of a sudden, right now, we're at this very unique inflection point, right? You know, the U.S. is going through vaccination. We're going back to work. All of a sudden, things seem to be shifting. And all people can talk about is sort of three things: inflation, the housing market, and employment. So from a broad picture perspective, can you give us sort of an understanding of why these three issues are popping up right now as we deal with the current economic climate?
I think there's a lot of interrelation between those three as well. But in a nutshell, I would say, you know, we have an economy that has come out of a very brief but very deep recession. And it is snapping back at a much quicker pace than I think anybody had envisioned it would. We typically, coming out of recessions, do see a jump in prices. That's been accentuated this time around by a few different factors. The fact that supply chains are constrained, there's a lot of pent-up demand, and the fact that price levels actually declined this time last year during the initial stages of the lockdown. So inflation, very much front of mind now and will be for the next several months. Employment, you know, wow, what a difference a year makes. I mean, we're definitely seeing things moving in the right direction. Record number of job openings. You know, we've seen the unemployment rate go from over 14% now down to about 6%. But there are still about 16 million Americans drawing some form of unemployment compensation. So as much as we're moving in the right direction and we like the trajectory, the fact is still have a long way to go. And then the housing market, you know, mortgage rates are really low. And the biggest thing is there's just this massive imbalance between supply and demand. When we emerged from the lockdown, demand took off at the exact same time that what was already a low supply got even lower. That's accentuated a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the bidding wars, the run-up in prices, and just this, you know, kind of flashback that we're getting to 2007 with people doing things like waiving appraisals and in home inspections and things like that.
It's a weird time. And I say this as someone who recently sold their house because I never thought somebody would close within 2 weeks. So it's just odd. So when we sort of take a step back and we look at each of these things, I want to get first into inflation. And I think it'd be really helpful for our listeners. How do we define inflation and how do we know it's rising?
Well, even the definition is somewhat up for debate because of how it's measured. There are various inflation measures. You know, each one's a little bit different. Which one actually represents how you and your household spend money, there isn't one, right? So the reality of it is we all have our own personal rate of inflation. But the broad barometers that are meant to be a proxy for that, one being the Consumer Price Index, which was just came out a couple of weeks ago, showed the biggest jump in prices since 2008. Some of those levels of prices saw the biggest one-month jump that we had seen in about 25 years. We're seeing that rapid snapback. You know, you look no further than things like, you know, rising home prices, the rising prices we've seen at the gas pump, the rising prices you see walking up and down the aisles of the supermarket. You know, people are starting to feel that household pressure, the supply chain constraints that a lot of businesses are feeling, really adding to that. A manufacturing survey that came out earlier this week, 40% of manufacturing companies in this survey said that they had raised prices, and 77% of them said that they had paid higher prices for their goods. So, you know, there's front of mind now, it's going to be for a few months, but it's really going to be a few months before we can answer the operative question, which is this just a brief spike, kind of like we see coming out of recessions typically, or are we seeing a more sustained level of increases that could be problematic to the economy down the road?
I think you bring up a good point, which is there's a couple of sort of schools of thought of what's going on right now. And I think the always challenging thing with economic indicators is you do need time to really let time pass to understand what's going on. From your vantage point, do you think this is just a short-term situation or is this something of a longer-term issue?
There's evidence of both. Frankly, I think anybody that, you know, says they definitively know at this point is either lying or purely guessing because we don't know, and it's going to be months. I mean, the inflation numbers have been, they have been distorted by what's called the base effect. The fact that prices this time last year were falling. On a year-over-year basis, it accentuates that increase. If you take that out over the course of the last 2 years, you ignore the declines last year, you look over the past two years, well, prices are increasing instead of at a 4.2% annual pace, it's 2.5%. Well, all of a sudden, that doesn't sound nearly so bad, right? So that base effect is going to play a role for a few months. And during that period of time, you're going to have a lot of pent-up demand. You have these ongoing supply chain issues. So some of that, we're just going to have to wait for that to come out in the wash before we can really get a read as to whether or not some of these elements are sustainable and longer lasting and contributing to a bigger downstream problem, or Federal Reserve was right. It was just temporary. And we see inflation revert to higher than normal level, but a more stable level afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, the Philadelphia Fed just came out with a report and it had some phrasing in there, I think, that caught people's eyes where they were comparing price increases to where it was back in 1980. And I think that that sort of catches people off guard when we start to compare back to that time period of very, very high inflation. What are your thoughts on that? Hearing those stats coming back, bringing in numbers from 1980?
So those of us of a certain age, the term inflation kind of brings back memories of a time where, you know, late 70s, early 80s, where inflation was off the charts and we paid a high price economically to get that tamed. Of course, we've had also 35 years of benefit of falling price levels over that period of time. And so, you know, there's a whole generation, maybe two, of people that really haven't seen high inflation, haven't even seen modest inflation for that matter. I think the dynamic has changed. The Federal Reserve changed their paradigm last summer. And I think this is one that's still broadly unappreciated, but they basically said that rather than act preemptively to tamp down inflation, they're going to wait until inflation is evident and above the threshold that they've previously designated before they decide to do anything about it. And even then, only if they're comfortable with where the employment market is. So longer term, I think that is a clear signal that we will see higher inflation than we had seen. We've been seeing inflation sub 2% for much of the last decade. The next decade is going to be a different story. We will see, even if inflation stays low, it's going to be a higher low than what we've seen. You know, we're more likely to return to the days of 3% inflation, you know, than the 2% or below that we'd seen over the last decade or so.
Are you surprised that this is the way the Fed wants to approach it?
I am, but I think also part of the reason that they have undergone this shift is lessons learned from the aftermath of the financial crisis, where we had a very long economic recovery, but it was sluggish and slow pace, and the employment market was slow to recover. Wage growth was even slower to rebound. And so I think a lot of not just the Fed shift, but even things that you've seen from the fiscal side is designed to maybe change that paradigm, speed up the recovery in things like the labor market and household wages.
A lot of our listeners are investors, you know, who are running their own portfolios. When you hear about high inflation or that we're going into a period of time where we're going to have some inflationary pressures, how should investors view this, right? Like, is this a panic moment? Like, what should we be thinking and feeling and doing?
You know, I mean, this is something that's going to be topical, not just now, but certainly through the balance of 2021 and possibly beyond. The operative question is, do we see a brief spike in prices and then, you know, we end up kind of getting back to the more or less normal slow growth economy that has an aging population and, you know, very low inflation? Or do we have we sown the seeds of a higher level of inflation? Because that's what's going to be problematic for the economy. If inflation stabilizes, even if it's 2.5 or 3% higher than what we'd seen in the last decade and a half, the economy can do just fine. It's if inflation gets up and sustains itself at higher levels to where we do have to have higher interest rates, that's where you're going to have some major headwinds to the economy, not just the recovery now, but what type of growth we might see down the road.
So, I mean, I think that's a good segue from inflation to the concept of employment numbers. We've gone through a wild ride with the unemployment numbers. And to your point, the most recent numbers is we're at about 6%. But when we look at anecdotal evidence, right, you're hearing these stories where people aren't able to hire, that even though we've got people who are unemployed, they are not able to find workers. You hear of restaurants being unable to reopen because they cannot get staff. So what's going on here?
Yes. I mean, those are widespread instances. I mean, there's a place right near me that they have had to cut their hours multiple times, not because the business isn't there, because they don't have the people to staff the place. And that's a very common sentiment. You hear that from business owners, you know, a lot of it in hospitality and restaurants, for example, but you know, even in other industries where, you know, they can't hire fast enough. You know, that could be a risk to the speed of the recovery that we see. Yes, some of this is because there's a mismatch of skills between what employers are looking for and what unemployed candidates have. Some of it is there's still concern about exposure to the virus, or, you know, even things like, you know, childcare issues or kids that are still doing school at home, you know, the issues that that raises. But then there are also, you know, instances where I saw, you know, it was a Wire story, but it had a great quote from, you know, a gentleman who said that he'd for 30 years, he'd worked in a theater as like the stage manager and the technician that does all the lighting and everything for 30 years. Well, that theater shut down in the early stages of the pandemic. So he's been out of work for a year. You know, as the economy's reopening, he's saying, look, I'm a master technician with 30 years experience. Well, am I supposed to go work in a pet store? And so, you know, whereas another couple of months, if not that theater, then other theaters and playhouses open. And, you know, this gentleman and other like them are able to return to the profession that they developed, you know, their skills in. And, you know, ultimately, that's what adds the most economic value when, you know, people are able to produce at their utmost. I'd say there are two sides of the coin. The reality is there's probably multiple sides to it.
One of the things that you hear a lot is people sort of saying, it's all because of the additional unemployment benefit, right? This is causing part of this issue with employment in general. But is that really what's driving some of this? The fact that people are getting paid more to not work?
On some level, perhaps it is. But, you know, that's just one of many variables at play. And even that, I think, is a very short-lived one. You're seeing, you know, a lot of states now, for example, they're putting an early end to the federal $300 a week supplement to unemployment benefits. And even the states that don't, it's going to sunset this summer. I think a lot of that, as frustrating as it is for employers now that need to hire in order to be able to do the business, you know, I think a lot of that is short-lived. The other thing is, nobody's really been able to quantify exactly to what extent that is at play. So I don't think it's right to dismiss it entirely, but I also don't think it's right to blame the entire labor shortfall on that.
I think, unfortunately, for better or for worse, it's those little anecdotes that get out there into the world that people start to blame it on that. You've seen also in situations where people who are on unemployment have actually been able to stabilize themselves from a personal finance standpoint. You know, I've heard people say this is the first time I've ever had real savings. So I think that there's also some benefits there as well to the long-term economy.
For sure. And that, you know, one of the Achilles heels of financial security has long been that people are undersaved for emergencies and retirement. And we really saw that undersaving for emergencies rear its head when, you know, we went into economic shutdown mode where everybody was told to go home and stay there. And you had, you know, severe income disruption at the household level. Yes, we have, you know, the other term you hear a lot of is K-shaped consumer recovery. Mm-hmm. And like the letter K, one leg is like an escalator going up. The other one's like an escalator going down. So yes, there are households that have paid down debt. They've boosted their savings. They're on more solid financial footing today than they were 15 months ago. But on the other hand, there are those that their financial situation has grown ever more precarious throughout this pandemic.
For those of us who write in personal finance, we always use that statistic from the Fed, right? That the average American cannot weather a $400 economic issue. It'll be interesting. And obviously, this doesn't play into inflation or employment, but this child tax credit that's going to start paying out this summer, I think will also offer a number of Americans more bandwidth for savings.
Also, too, it's going to contribute to spending, too. So that could be another engine in terms of bringing this economic recovery about sooner and faster than many had expected just 9 or 12 months ago.
So that brings us to the housing market. And I have to tell you, I mean, I have clients all across the country. I know people all around the country. And regardless of who you're talking to, people are frenzied about housing. And you hear lots of different things, right? Millennials are getting their first time to buy. People are working from home. There's a supply and demand issue. What is going on with housing? And is this a bubble?
It is a massive imbalance between supply and demand is what has caused this situation that we're in. At this point in May of 2021, it's not a bubble. It's not sustainable, but it's not what I would call a bubble. Now, if we have the same conversation a year from now, I may feel much differently.
Do you think it's not sustainable then?
Well, I mean, it's not sustainable simply because you've got a level of demand that has been heightened by people that need a change of scenery can now get a change of scenery. They no longer are tied to a high-cost metro area. They're able to move to another part of the country or move out into the suburbs. People that just have, hey, if I'm going to work from home, I need more space. You know, those type of things. At the time where you've got supply of homes available for sale at a record low, it was low coming into the pandemic. It's only gotten lower since. Now, you know, eventually we'll get to an equilibrium where prices are not going to be able to sustainably go up at this rate because there are only so many homeowners that can afford those payments, even with mortgage rates as low as they are. And the other one key difference we see now from the previous housing bubble is lending standards are still very strict. You don't see the insane practices that contributed to the previous housing boom and eventual bust. Lending standards really put some guardrails around it. So, you know, there is a ceiling to just how many people are going to be able to afford homes as prices can continue to go up. This could run a little while longer, but I think the reality of it is we're likely looking at a period where home prices stagnate for an extended period, more likely than see a sharp pullback. But again, this is a developing story, as they say. A year from now, I think that, you know, the outlook might be much different.
You bring up a really good point. I mean, I know from having clients buying in the market and so on, the mortgage industry is inundated. They are not in any way, shape, or form prepared for this level of transactions. It's been amazing watching them sort of struggle with balancing being very strict on the rules for underwriting and meet the demand of so many different people doing transactions.
The bulk of the demand has been on the refinancing side more so than home purchases. I think that that's part of what will ultimately get us to a little bit of an equilibrium is that, you know, as rates go up, a lot of that refinancing traffic is going to die down. Home purchases will be, you know, constitute more of the total mortgage originations that are out there. You know, so a lot of those lenders will, just as we saw in the early stage of the pandemic, where it took them a while to catch up. You know, I think same thing, you know, you could find lenders that find themselves overstaffed pretty quickly if rates were to jump suddenly and undercut a lot of that refinancing traffic they've had.
I mean, I think the thing though with housing, which I've always find fascinating, is the generational aspect of it, right? So I think boomers have surprised. We all thought they were going to quote unquote downsize. And I don't think we've seen that shift with them. And for a long time, millennials and the beginning of Gen Z, because Gen Zers are only 25 right now, the oldest of them, originally were having trouble getting into the market. Do you think once sort of the dust settles and we start to sift through the data, are we going to see certain generational trends that have occurred during this time period?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest shift is millennials, right? I mean, over the last decade, there was a lot of gnashing of teeth, particularly in the real estate community, about, oh, millennials are not buying houses at the same pace as preceding generations did at the same age. You know, what we had found in a lot of our consumer polling is millennials had the same preference or higher for housing as a long-term investment as than any other age group. So it's not that they had an aversion to housing. Yeah, I think at the time it was a matter of, look, you know, it's one thing when you're, you know, in your late 20s and you're living in a downtown loft with a couple of roommates and you're working your way up the career ladder and you need that career mobility and that's why you're renting. You know, but by the time you get to your mid to late 30s and you know, you've settled down, you got a family, you're going to want a place in the suburbs with a backyard and a garage. And sure enough, you know, that's, I think, the dynamic that's really starting to take hold. You know, millennials are, you know, all the way up to age 40 now. And so you've seen a surge of home buying and a lot of that coming from those millennials that, you know, they've reached that life stage where now's the time to put down the roots. And it's come at a time where, like, the pandemic has accelerated some of that, you know, but so too things like the low mortgage rates.
You and I think, are both Gen Xers, and I think we all bought houses out of the gate. Very different experience compared to the millennial experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what contributed to a lot of the angst that we had seen regarding the millennials there in the initial years is that, you know, we've had low mortgage rates for years. And it was this, well, why aren't millennials buying houses? Why aren't millennials buying houses? And it was much more of a life stage factor than it was attitude toward housing itself.
Well, and I think the other thing is you and I are members of the last generation where student loans were not as intense as they are today. You know, I always talk about the fact that I still have my student loans because they're at 3%, right? Whereas I think the millennials came out with so much more debt than our generation did. And that's slowed them a bit on the housing front.
It has. It's been a factor to some extent, for sure. Although I think for, you know, a lot of millennials, you know, that's countered by the fact that they have higher earnings as a result of that education on which they incurred that debt.
So inflation, employment, housing, you know, we've got just a few more moments left. How should we just be taking this period of time as we sift through it, as we start to see friends out and about and people are talking about all this stuff? What should we be taking as sort of strategic view on how to navigate this time in the economy?
Well, we are going to see a pace of economic growth this year that is probably the fastest since about 1983 or 84. You know, so this rapid snapback from the depths of the pandemic. You know, 2022, you know, may also have a sort of an accelerated pace relative to the norm. But I think by the time you get to the second half of 2022 and certainly into 2023, as the dust on a lot of stimulus measures and things start to settle, you know, as we have settled back into our new normal, you know, we're likely to be back to that slow growth economy with an aging population. And so I think we have to be mindful. There's a lot of money sloshing around. Interest rates are at record lows. You see a lot of crazy things happening from a valuation standpoint, not only in housing, but in financial markets. And so I think, you know, it's going to be important to kind of keep our heads about us because This is a very frenzied environment, and frenzies don't last forever.
So keep your head is the best advice.
Yeah, the frenzies don't last forever. And the other thing is oftentimes they don't end well, particularly if you haven't kept your head.
Yeah, well, hopefully we won't have a hard landing. I think that everybody's been through so much financially over the past couple of years. It would be nice if it just sort of moved into a soft growth mode versus having any major trauma in the housing market or with high inflation. So, Greg, I know you write a lot and commentate a lot. So, well, please let our audience know where they can find out more about you.
Bankrate.com is the website. We have a wealth of contributors and people on staff that write content geared toward helping consumers make informed financial decisions. We've got a free search engine where you can find the best and most competitive rates to do things like refinance your mortgage, get a better credit card, find the best savings account for that emergency savings. And then we also have calculators to help people make out that determination of how much house can I afford at a time when the competition is so heated. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @BankRateGreg.
And now on to the panel portion of our show. Today we have our very own Kirk Chisholm. Hey, Kirk, how are you?
Hey, Megan. How's it going?
And I'm doing well. I'm doing real well. How about you, Barb? And we also have our very own Barb Friedberg.
Hi, Megan. Hi, Kirk. So happy to be here.
Well, it's good to have both of you on. I thought the interview with Greg was really interesting and really timely because I know, Kirk, you're dealing with clients, Barb. You're commentating and people are talking about inflation, housing, and employment. So I thought we could start our panel portion of the show today on the big I, inflation. It's finally here. And I'd love to get both of your takes on, is this a short-term blip, which Greg sort of addressed in the interview, or do you think inflation is here to stay? And I think, Barb, I'm going to start with you, because I know you have a very distinct point of view on inflation.
I do. And because I happen to be the dinosaur of the panel, I lived through the 1980s inflation. And for those of you that weren't born or that were babies at the time, the inflation rates topped like 10%, 12%. They were crazy. And of course, what accompanied those was awesome high yields on cash. So that was a good side. Now, here we are with inflation creeping upwards and yields on your cash at, sub 1%. So I think inflation is scary now that we're seeing it creep up to near 4%. Clearly, it's not like 10 or 11 or 12. But if you go to the gas pump or you go to the supermarket or you're looking to buy something and you're seeing prices trend upwards and you're not seeing that in your paycheck, then you may start to get worried that your dollar is not going to go as far as it had previously. And that's the scary part about inflation. So is it going to continue? That darn crystal ball of mine is just on the fritz. I don't know. So what do we do? I'm all about the solution. So how can we cope with the possibility that inflation, in fact, at a higher level, may be here to stay? The Fed came out and said at present, we're not going to do anything to control inflation right now. So we may see it continuing to creep upward. So what can we do in our lives and what can we invest in our lives to help counteract the fact that we're spending more money? And I don't want to monopolize the whole conversation. So I guess we'll get into the investment ideas, after Kirk has a chance to speak. But the fact is, we are seeing inflation. We've got to figure out some ways to prepare for it and adjust both our investing and our lifestyle so that it's not going to, be a huge burden for us.
No, I think you've put it very well, Barb, and I think we will get to solutions. I want to hear what our friend on the East Coast thinks about inflation. Is this a blip or here to stay?
This is a great topic. I love talking about this topic. This is something I've spent a lot of time studying in the last 12 years since the Great Recession, as people like to call it. I think what's interesting is, we have this inflation bias, we've had inflation bias for, I think, probably 70 years now, like 65, 70 years. We've pretty much had constant inflation with no bouts of deflation. I mean, if you look back at history, going back way back hundreds of years, like 200 years, inflation, deflation was normal up until about, I think it was 1955, which pretty much didn't have deflation after that because the Fed was more or less managing it. And what I think is fascinating is, I mean, inflation, deflation are natural events. They do naturally occur in normally operating economies. I don't know that I would say we have a normally operating economy anymore. It's more of a managed economy. What I think is fascinating is we just have this opinion that we just have inflation. We've always had it. We're always going to have it. It's kind of along the same lines as real estate always goes up, you know, along that kind of thinking. And I think that's really dangerous thinking to have because, you know, if you think it's always going to happen, you're going to be really surprised if we ever have deflation. You know, if you look back at the last 12 years, we've had pretty much low to no inflation, or in some cases, I would say we've had deflation, even though you could argue whether that was the case or not. What happens is people generally look at inflation with a broad lens. They just say, we either have inflation or deflation or low inflation. Well, the reality is it's none of those. And at the same time, it's all of them. So inflation is, especially now, it may not have always been the case historically, but especially now, inflation, deflation, or whatever you want to call it, depends on what topic you're talking about. Are we talking about wages? Are we talking about commodity prices? Are we talking about asset prices? You know, depending on what you're looking at, it could be varied, right? So we have price deflation and have for the last 20 years for technology. The price for technology has not changed. If you want to buy not the high-end computers, because some of those, they really soup up. But if a high-end computer is a 5 and you maybe look at one that's like a 4, it's a mid to high level, it costs me the same amount now as it did 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And yet the quality's gotten better. So I would say more likely than not, we've had deflation for a lot of things. I mean, look at TVs, look at certain technologies we have, your phone. You could argue the price is going up, but the quality is hugely expanded and you're paying a similar price. So you're having deflation there. We've had commodity deflation for, I would say, I can't remember when it started, but it was at least since the Great Recession. It's only started to pick up now. But yet we've had asset price inflation for the last 12 years. Stocks have gone up. Real estate's pretty much gone up. So it's not a binary thing. It operates in little pockets. And I think what's interesting is, I think to answer the question more directly, I think this inflation is transient, as the Fed says. And you all know that I'm not a huge believer in what the Fed says, but I think in this case, they're accurate. Most of the inflation is coming off of the supply chain problems. And the supply, I don't want to say the supply chain is broken, but in many ways, it's severely damaged because the world's shutting down. And that is causing this inflation. I don't think it's going to be long term. I think we've pulled way too much of our productivity forward from the future with all the money printing and all the debt creation. I think we're in a similar situation that Japan has been for the last 30 years. The difference is Japan hit deflation and couldn't get out of it. I think we've had similar issues. If you don't believe me, then, you know, look at all the money that's printed, and yet we haven't had inflation or hyperinflation as many people have predicted. You can't just look at the inflation numbers and assume that we have inflation. You also have to look at the secondary effects. You know, does it feel like we have inflation? Are your food prices going through the roof every day? They've risen, yeah, but you have to look at everyday effects, like look at gas prices. You have to look at what you're paying for and look at wages. Wages have been stagnating for over 20 years. So, you know, there's a lot of effects that come into play, but I would say the likelihood is we are going back to a low inflation or no inflationary environment after this blip hits us. That would be my thinking.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you gave us some really good insight there. And I love that term, inflation bias. I think that's very well said. You know, and I'm on your team on this, Kirk. I think this Woo-hoo. Is, in the scheme of things, I think this is a relatively short-term thing. I mean, try to buy a used car in this country right now. But I think the thing is, you know, when we look at this from an investment perspective, the question is, thing that I would say is, I don't think this is a strategic change to your asset allocation. I think there's tactical changes that can be made. But what are some of the tactical investments you can make with your portfolio. And Kirk, I'm going to ask you that first because I know you're client facing and you're dealing with this all the time.
Yeah, it's a great question, Megan, because, you know, it's one thing to predict whether we have inflation, deflation. It's another to predict what you should be putting your money in. And I think a good example is, this is something that we should reiterate here, is, you know, the market is forward looking. So if you look at what's happened, like the market has already predicted that we're going to have inflation, and it's happened. And people have bid up the prices of commodities. That is a good asset class to look at. I mean, think about this. When is the last time people talked about commodities? Maybe it was probably the 90s or early. People used to say stocks, bonds, and commodities. Nobody talks about that anymore because they've been out of favor. But commodities tend to do well in inflationary times, as we've seen. They have done well up till now. Gold tends to do well. I say that it's also a commodity, but it's a precious metal, which has a certain place in our lives and our hearts and our culture, that gold is something that's been a store of value for long periods of time. Tips tend to do well because they're inflation protected. Real estate does well because real estate is, it's really hedged against inflation over time. And, you know, beyond that, I think you have to kind of be a little careful of certain assets like bonds. We have not looked at bonds for a while. Rates are so low, it's not even worth the risk you're taking. But, you know, and equities, it's a hodgepodge. It depends on what you're investing in with equities. I don't want to monopolize all the good ideas, but I think, you know, if you're looking to invest in certain areas, those are the areas certain that we like. And beyond that, you can get into more complexity. But I'll let Barb kind of talk about that a little bit too.
Yeah, Barb, I'd love to hear your point of view. And can we get Barbapedia just sort of to get a quick definition of tips? We hear that term all the time, but I think it's always good to sort of refresh what that actually means.
So glad you asked, because that was on tap anyhow. And again, Kirk, thank you for leaving me something to talk about, because, you know, really, you are covering like most of the important asset classes. So let's start, first of all, what are they? Our government has a website called treasurydirect.gov. And there you can buy specific securities that are designed to protect your purchasing power from inflation. And both the I-bonds, which stands for inflation bonds, and TIPS, which are Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, have a little bit different functions. I'm not going to get into those, but the bottom line is both of those are designed to keep up with inflation. So no, your money's not going to make a huge return on those, but they will help your dollar continue to buy the same amount. Now, the ways that you can get those investments, and I always have a portion of inflation-protected securities in my portfolio, and I'll get to that in a minute. The way that you can buy those are, you can just go to the website, treasurydirect.com, .gov, and buy them individually, or you can also buy a fund, and they're called, like, you know, most fund companies offer inflation protected bond funds. And again, don't think you're going to get some awesome return. You won't, but it will protect the money that you have invested from losing value due to inflation. So I like those. And all of the asset classes that Kirk talked about have historically been known to do well during inflationary periods. Additionally, I'm going to throw in a couple more, and then I'm going to give you an overview of how to invest during inflation. So wait for it. Okay, foreign companies sometimes can be a good hedge against inflation, because many foreign firms are involved in the industrial and commodity sectors, which, as Kirk mentioned, tend to do well during inflation. Additionally, you might see small cap companies prospering because they're leaner and they can profit from rising prices. Real estate is typically a good hedge against inflation. So what do you do now? Do you blow up your portfolio because, wow, I want to inflation proof it? Here's your answer. A diversified portfolio works during all market segments. And what that typically means is it's not a bad idea to have an allocation to some of these asset classes that will prosper during inflation in a reasonable amount. And we're not going to tell you how much or what percentages, because despite what Kirk and Megan believe to be the truth, I myself am not going out on a limb and predicting anything. So because no one knows the future, it's a good idea to just keep a diversified portfolio, have some exposure to some of these asset classes that will have a tendency to do better during inflation. And if you're wrong, you're wrong. And you will be. Every asset class will not perform well during every market scenario. And because of that fact, that's why we introduce diversification into our portfolios to capture the ups and also to guard against the downs. So you won't have all your money in a losing asset class either.
I think the two of you gave great answers. And I think my only quick follow-up question is, when we're talking about doing this stuff, we're talking about a couple percentage points. We're not talking about 10, 15, 30% of your portfolio moving into these types of asset
classes. Absolutely. Small moves.
Small moves. Excellent. Well, I want to sort of shift gears and move to the part of the interview where we talked about the real estate market. And, you know, it's interesting because the CEO of Redfin posted a bunch of statistics last night on the real estate market based on Redfin studies. And I'm just going to read them off to you. And I want to get your reactions as we go through it. But right now, there are more realtors than there are listings. Inventory across the country is down 37% year over year to a record low. The average house is selling in 17 days. And home prices are up a record amount, 24% year over year to a record high. And still homes sell on average for 1.7% higher than the asking price. Now, what's also coming out statistically, as he points out, is lumber prices are up 300%. And when Redfin surveyed 2,000 home buyers, 63% reported having bid on a home they hadn't seen in person. And what was really interesting, and Greg talked about this in the interview about the K-shaped recovery, is that what Redfin found is that it's a K-shaped recovery and K-shaped mobility. So with people moving, what they found is by moving, and even if they buy similar size houses to larger size houses, they're having more disposable income. And the migration to lower cost areas are leading more families to let one parent stop working. And then at the same time, what they're finding is 90% of people making $100,000 or more are going to be working virtually, compared to 10% of those earning $40,000 or less per year who need to actually have housing in the areas in which they work. So I know I gave you guys a lot of statistics, but what do you think? Is that sort of capturing the frenzy we're seeing out there?
I think so. I love these statistics because I'm a kind of a data geek. So I look at this and I think it's a really good reflection of what's going on. I think it's a weird environment. It feels different than it did in like 2005, 2007, where people were kind of going crazy and, you know, buying houses. And I think that was for a very different reason. This has very different reasons for why it's all screwed up. But I mean, lumber price up 300%. That does not have a small impact on real estate. And I think what's interesting, and we talked about this in a prior show, Megan, that when you talk about real estate, you know, real estate, you said it's 1.7% higher than asking price. I'm surprised it's not higher because I think a lot of people put an asking price that is lower to start a bidding war. And the realtors are asking people to do that so that you get more bidders and more people bidding up the price. So I think that's probably maybe a false data point, if you will. But the fact is people are paying all cash. They're not looking at the house. It's scary. It's a feeding frenzy for buyers. I would not want to be a buyer in this market. I think this is where people make bad decisions because they feel like they have to. And I find it to be challenging. Real estate's expensive on the East Coast. It's hard to find good values. And people are still paying all cash and no contingencies. That's a hugely risky proposition for the biggest asset of most people's life. If you're paying a lot of money for this house, you're not looking at the house or doing any sort of inspections beforehand. You're paying all cash. I don't know where all these people are getting all cash. That to me seems a bit weird that so many people have all cash to bid on houses. But in looking at this, it's scary and it makes me wonder, like, how long is this going to continue? And when that trend stops, how is it going to swing the other way? Because what tends to happen with trends is we have this concept that, you know, most people in the investment industry know about, which is reversion to the mean, which is there's kind of like this trend that things follow, like the indexes, the US indexes follow a trend. And there's what we call reversion to the mean, which is if things get a little bit too far off of the beaten path, it tends to revert back the other way just as strongly. And so it makes me wonder, with all of these spikes in lumber prices, in just generally prices for goods and supplies for building houses, like anything, it's not just lumber, it's all inventory. When that spikes up, at what point does that go the other way? Because all of a sudden people cut down more trees now. So now you've got an overabundance of supply and people don't need as much. So it tends to revert. There was a quote that I love that somebody said about mining stocks. It's the cure for high prices is high prices. The cure for low prices is low prices, meaning that the economy corrects itself. Because if you have low prices, then nobody cuts down trees, but people still need wood. So they bid up the price and then the price corrects itself. So in a normal economy, this stuff corrects itself just based on supply and demand. So it makes me wonder how much lumber there's going to be out there in the next year because so many people are cutting it down. So those are kind of my initial thoughts, Megan.
Barb, you've always got a point of view. What do you think? And then before we got on the show today, you were telling me that your daughter is looking for a house, the challenges that has been.
Yeah. And real estate is local. So we are all, Kirk, Megan, and I, on the coasts of the United States. Those are historically very expensive areas. Whereas if you live in the central part or the southern part of the United States, you're going to find a much different pricing environment. So that's one thing. But I want to take a step back and say, let's look at real estate from two different perspectives. One is the buying and selling of our own homes or our kids' homes or whatever. And then let's look at real estate as an investment. So if you're looking to buy a house now or sell a house now, then these Redfin figures, they hit you where it hurts, because if you're a buyer, if you're a seller, not so much. But buyers are being caught up in what is a terrible imbalance of supply and demand. And Kirk alluded to this, which simply means there are a ton more people wanting to buy a house than there are available houses. And because of that fact, people will pay more and more and more and more because there are way more people chasing very few homes. And I loved what Kirk said, which is, do not panic. Don't pay some crazy price because you feel like you'll never have another opportunity. You will. These vast imbalances do work themselves out until what we in the economics field call come to an equilibrium, where the amount of supply and demand equals out. So if you're looking to buy a house, now is a frustrating time. And I was telling Megan and Kirk before we started, my daughter and her husband, they live in the Bay Area. They're looking for a house. And in their price range, which is, you know, if I said this out loud, those of you in the middle parts of the country would think, holy crap, you can get a mansion for the amount of money they're willing to spend. Well, in San Francisco, you get a shack for $1 million. So if that gives you an idea of what's going on in this area. And there are even very few homes available in the Bay Area for under, you know, $1,500,000. There's very few even available homes. And of those available homes, they're not being sold for 1% over. They're being sold for 10% over, 20% over, 30% over. So regardless of where you live, my advice is don't stop looking because, you know, you may find something you like within your price range and put a bid in that you feel is reasonable. If you get it, great. If you don't, on the flip side, rents are going down. That same daughter I was referring to, they just are continuing to rent. Their actual monthly rent payment did go down. So this too will change. Now, on to the investment side. If you've listened to this show more than once, you know I love investing in real estate. I've been investing in real estate for 30 plus years. It's a wonderful asset class because due to the fact that they're not making any more land, it will appreciate. We don't know how much, we don't know when it will take. But so how do you get into making sure that you have a portion of your investment portfolio in the real estate market? And I think everyone should have a little bit of allocation to that asset class. You can get into it by being a landlord yourself, which, you know, is a pain in the neck and also very, you know, difficult given the scenario now. Or you can invest in real estate investment trusts or REITs, which capture a whole variety of different types of real estate. They're traded on the stock market, trade just like stocks. Or you can get into some of the newer ways to invest in real estate, which are real estate crowdfunding. There's tons of different opportunities for that as well. So, does that wrap it up for real estate, Megan?
I think it does. And I think just to piggyback on something you said, because it's something I said to somebody yesterday, you know, if you don't have to be buying in this market, it doesn't hurt you to wait. Investors get rewarded by patience. And I think to jump into a frenzy, I don't know if it's the most prudent thing to do. And so, you know, as Greg said on the interview, keep your head. So we've talked about inflation. We've talked about real estate. I just want to, in the last final moments, touch on employment. And I think employment is always that tough thing. We hear that number. We know it's a reflection of the economy. But should we be deciphering that number to mean anything for our portfolio? And I'm going to quickly throw it out there to Barb. Do you factor the employment numbers that come out monthly in managing your portfolio, or is this just another piece of economic data?
Okay, Megan. Well, as I told you before the interview, here's where I bear it all. Love the statistics. Don't act on them. Don't do anything about them. I find it interesting to look at the employment numbers as part of the economic piece of the overall economy, but I don't make any changes to investment portfolios based on that.
I think that that's like a lot of people. I would make the argument that in a lot of ways I'm the same. So, Kirk, I know you like to be the contrarian here.
One quick more thing to say.
Yeah.
One thing that the employment number will tell us, and again, I don't think it's actionable, at least not for me, but the employment number will tell us the strength of the economy, or it will contribute to the strength of the economy. So the more jobs that are being created, the more growth the economy is experiencing. So that's one way to kind of look at it and understand it. And we like a growing economy because that means companies are prospering and citizens are also prospering.
No, I think that that's a fair assessment. So Kirk, you like to be the contrarian of the group. Any way that you factor some of this stuff in when you're looking at employment numbers?
Well, I'm going to be a contrarian in a different way, Megan. When we look at things like unemployment, or really many of the government statistics, frankly, is they are statistics, and statistics can be managed and manipulated and misunderstood. And I think if you look at a headline number, it's kind of like what we talked about earlier with inflation. If you just look at the one number, you're not going to really understand what's going on. You're just going to say, oh, inflation's up or inflation's down. But there could be all sorts of reasons for that, right? I mean, we just went through a global pandemic. The global economy was shut down for close to a year. And somehow that's not going to affect things. Well, there's going to be huge changes and rogue waves going through the statistics as we kind of get back up to quote unquote normal or normal-ish. So I think, you know, the trends are important. So it's important that it's trending in the right direction, but the actual numbers, to me, they don't mean as much. I mean, you think about it this way, you look at the unemployment rate. I think before we had the pandemic, we had the lowest unemployment numbers ever. I don't know if it was ever, but certainly as far back as I looked, which is somewhat shocking. But if you understand how they calculate them, maybe not so much, right? You know, if it's 2% unemployment, but you're not including a bunch of people on that number, then it's not really an accurate number. So I think to go along with what's been said, it's the trend that's important. It's important that people are coming back to work and that they're getting jobs. You need to understand where those jobs are coming from. You know, are they coming from the service sector? Are they coming from the farming sector? Like, all of that's really important because, for example, you know, one of the transportation is one of the more popular jobs in central U.S. in like the flyover states. I looked at a chart a while ago and it showed most states, like transportation is the biggest employer. Now, if you start having automated vehicles, all of a sudden that's going to be an issue. So you need to understand what the numbers look like and why they look the way they do. The other thing too is when they look at it, they have the expected number and then they have the actual number. And of course, the markets move based on the difference between the two. You know, is there a surprise? Is there not a surprise? So I look at it from the trend perspective rather than the analytical of exactly what this means, because I think what's really important is price is the final arbiter. So how is the market reacting to this? So if you don't understand all of this, you know, data that we're talking about, and I love data, if you don't understand and you just want to take a real simple view of it, look at how the market's reacting to it, because the market is going to tell you what it thinks of that employment number. So that is ultimately all that matters anyway, because the market is going to move in advance of what they think the direction of the economy is going to be. So if you really want to know whether it's good or bad, you can just look at how the market reacted, and that's going to tell you more than the actual data most likely will.
I think, you know, as we wrap up, it's always interesting having people like Greg on the show who are looking at the data, looking at it, trying to understand it. So any final thoughts, Kirk, on inflation, housing, the economy in general that we just want to throw out there?
Really, the takeaways are you always need to be mindful. Don't just read headlines. I'm trying to think who does this. I don't know if there's anybody who does this specifically, but I see this around. There's this like magazine cover indicator. You know, when you start seeing magazine covers in certain magazines that start talking about inflation, you know, all right, this is probably the end of the cycle because it's a headline on this magazine that has to do with like science. That's a bad example, but something is totally unrelated to the financial markets. And I know Barron's just had a headline that said, I think it was the big eye or whatever it said. And when people are talking about it, it tends to be a little bit late to the game. So if you're just hearing about it now and you're thinking, all right, maybe I should prepare for inflation, take a step back and look at some of the asset classes that we talked about and see how much have they already been overinflated. And just understand that if you're getting in now, you may be late to the party if it's transient. Now, if it's not transient, then, you know, you should be fine. But just think about it. Don't just react to inflation because you saw it in the headlines, because most likely, I mean, there's this adage that Wall Street has, which is buy in the rumor and sell in the news. Well, the news is when it's on the cover of a magazine. It's too late. So you just need to be aware of why you're making your decisions. And if you're making portfolio decisions based on inflation, you should look at all possible outcomes. This is why diversification is important. It's because if you don't know, if you're not spending all day, like, you know, Megan and I, like we live in this stuff with our daily jobs. And if you're not in the weeds every single day, then you might not be up to speed with some of the things happening because you probably have a real job that doesn't require you to spend all your time doing this. It takes a lot of time to stay up with this sort of stuff. So the point of diversification is so that you don't need to be the smartest person out there. You're going to be prepared for inflation. You're going to be prepared for deflation. I mean, I remember when I started my career in 99 that no one was talking about gold. It was not on anybody's conversation. If you talked about it, people would laugh at you. But yet, if you really wanted to put together an allocation for a portfolio, gold should have been in there. And I remember looking at models that were really old models that had gold in there. And I was like, why would I invest in gold? I mean, I was green at the time, so I didn't know. I mean, why would I invest in gold? Because it's going down. Why would I invest in it? Same reason for not investing in commodities for the last 20 years, because they're going down. But yet the whole point of diversification is because you don't know when that's going to change. You don't know when it's going to go from stagnant or low inflation or deflation up to inflation, so that you need to be prepared for all cases. And that's the point of diversification. That's kind of what I would leave the listeners with this week.
Well, thanks for being on the show. How about you, Barb? Any final thoughts?
Kirk really said it well. So I am going to put in the show notes an article that I wrote recently about how to prepare for inflation with 8 actionable tips. So it's kind of a nice summary to give you some ideas, because we didn't really talk about the consumer-facing side of what do you do as a consumer to counteract rising costs. And there's some lifestyle stuff you can do. So with that, I am Barbara Friedberg. You can find me at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance and at RoboAdvisor Pros. See you all next time. Bye.
And I'm Megan Gorman, and thanks for joining us. And Kirk, I'm going to turn it over to you for your final words.
All right. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us, Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all our resources, show notes, and archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get better access to some of the top guests that I know you're going to want to hear. So have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.